Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The mortgage meltdown did a number on more than just mortgages. It changed the dynamic of the entire housing market and helped bring about the greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression. Prices have stabilized, but in a report by WOSU's Mandy Trimble this week, Realty Tracks Vice President Darren Bloomquist said he worries about outside investors who may overpay for foreclosed properties.
It could be creating a sort of a bubble. It's not the same sort of bubble that we saw in the last housing boom and bust, where it was that bubble was facilitated by loose lending. This is a totally different phenomenon in many ways, but it could be pushing prices up to higher than they really should be.
Joining us now to talk about that and more in the Central Ohio real estate market is Todd Helpbringer, president of Helpbringer Mortgage Services. Welcome back.
Good morning. Thank you.
Also joining us is Rob Vogt. He's real estate analyst at Vogt Santer Insights. Welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So what about what Darren Bloomquist told Mandy, that bank repossessions in the Columbus metro area have nearly doubled this year? That means they're getting caught up.
Right.
Clearing for purchase of a bunch of properties left over from the meltdown. Do you agree that these outside investors buying those foreclosed properties will artificially inflate the prices?
You know, I think I was thinking about this earlier when we started talking about it. A lot of those guys that go in and buy those foreclosed properties, they're buying them for cash. So I don't think they'll be able to inflate the prices beyond what the market will demand.
Because they're, why does
it? Well, because, so let's say they buy the house for, I'm guessing, $25,000. They put in some money to fix it up.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them I see keep the homes because they realize the value that they maybe can rent them for $700 or $800 a month, and they only got maybe $35,000 into them. So a lot of those guys will keep those properties on as rental properties. And if they do decide eventually to sell them on the open market, the price of the neighborhood will decide what they're going to be able to sell them for.
They won't be forced to sell them
for
more.
I think that's a really good point, Todd, and it sort of ties in a lot to the news that we've had recently regarding Mayor Coleman's effort to eliminate a lot of these vacant homes and go after the slum landlords that
right.
we have. So if we have responsible investors who are actually going in and buying a property at a discounted price, making improvements to that property, and actually getting families back into those houses, I think that's a positive thing for Columbus. It's a good thing.
Yeah,
we just got to make sure that we're getting responsible property owners who are willing to put the money into those properties and bring them up to a safe, livable condition.
We've talked about absentee landlords before and what they can do to a neighborhood. Do we have any ideas or any sense about how many people are like that out there who are absentee, that, you know, how much of the market is owned by people who don't live here?
I'm not sure anyone has a good grasp of that.
Because so much of it's
right.
hidden.
Right. I mean, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I think you can drive down just about any street in many of the inner city neighborhoods and see that there's a lot of vacant houses that are owned by people not from our area and frankly probably live in our area as well, but mm-hmm. not taking the responsibility to really maintain these houses. So I think that's a tough one to get. But if we're really getting legitimate investors to come into the market and spend money and improve the quality of that housing, it's got to have a positive impact on us in the long run.
Yeah, it's just going to take some time, as everything does. As the investors go in there, start building them up and get a stabilization of the neighborhood, it'll bring back the people that maybe couldn't afford to buy, but they can rent. And that's where the value comes in for the investor, because they're getting reasonable prices, putting in some money, but then getting rents at $600 and $700 a month.
And frankly, Todd, I think that a prudent investor would recognize that at some point they'll be able to sell that house to
right.
a family again and get homeowners back into these neighborhoods. So, you know, at least if it's a legitimate investor and they're making improvements to it, it's got to be a positive thing, a long-term positive thing for our neighborhoods.
I keep reading the word normal, as in getting back to normal levels regarding real estate or whatever it might be regarding housing and the real estate market in general. What is normal? Has normal changed? Is there a new normal? Do we want to get... I don't even know what it is anymore.
Yeah, and I don't think normal, probably not the best word to use on that, because the industry is always changing. Now, what we went through, 25 years ago when I got in this industry, really made sense. The lending made sense. Then we got into, I'll call abnormal, where it was basically lending to almost anyone, whether or not they could afford the home. So now we've got that retraction, and now we're going back to forward of, hey, here we have responsible lending. We're going to make sure people qualify for their homes.
Back to the olden days.
Yeah, olden days, I've said this 1,000 times, as it always should have been. There was never a point where it made sense to give a loan to a client that showed no ability to repay. It just doesn't make sense. And everyone touted what great you know, financials, they could sell these on the open market to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, mm-hmm. and everyone's going to make a ton of money. But if the client can't pay you back, it doesn't matter what the rate of interest is. It's a zero-sum game.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the normal will be, hopefully, getting us back to a 2 to 4% appreciation, get home ownership steadily going up, but not big, you know, not big spikes, but maybe home ownership goes up 3 to 5% a year. And homes appreciate 2 to 4% a year.
So, Todd, do you think the lenders will begin to relax some of their requirements that they're involved with right now?
You know, I don't know. I think, as we talked earlier, we're getting ready to go through another change of this Dodd-Frank bill about the qualified mortgages, where mm-hmm. they're basically, I use the word loosely, making us, but this is something that we should have always been doing as a mortgage broker, a mortgage bank, or a lender, is making sure that we look at the client's overall picture and making sure that they can afford the payment. I think that is one thing that we should have always been doing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the real estate market today. All right, so you mean there's a little morality involved in being a lender then? Because
let's hope
that's so. A moral thing. You could still make, I mean, someone made a boatload of money off all those bad mortgages.
Right. And those guys aren't around anymore. I mean, I remember back.
You're still here, though.
Because I never did one subprime loan. I couldn't get my brain wrapped around subprime. If Ann can't afford 4%, why would I give Ann 8%? I mean, yeah, I'll make more money, but Ann can't afford it. So it doesn't make sense. It just never made sense to offer someone something they can't afford. So I think, yes, we all have to have morals and just hit, get a base hit every day. My dad always taught me, get a base hit every day and you'll be doing fine.
Let's talk about that, the, you know, getting back to the 2 to 4% appreciation mm-hmm. level. Recovery in Central Ohio is slow and steady, they say, but it's swifter elsewhere. Central Ohio, let's see, I think it's been, they're saying it's around 4% now. It's 6 to 7%, and other parts of the country may be higher. So does that mean the rest of the country is going somewhere that we don't want to go, or what?
That's a tough one to answer, and you have to keep in mind, too, that we're talking about overall trends that exist in Central Ohio, that we've got certainly a lot of areas, Dublin, Arlington, Westerville, Bexley, that have seen higher rates of appreciation, and some of our other areas have not. I think that's a direct reflection of the economy, the fact that our job growth has not been as stellar as other portions of the country that are attracting new households into those areas because of the job opportunities that they provide. So it's a fairly complicated equation when you start to break it all down. And I think we have outperformed many of the markets in the Midwest because we have had a healthier economy and we have been able to provide jobs and recover from the jobs that we lost during the recession. But it's just going to take some time. And I think Todd's point about steady, consistent growth is a good one to live under.
Yeah. Central Ohio home prices are undervalued by about 10% compared to 4% nationally, according to, is it Trulia's Bubble Watch?
Trulia, yep.
Which monitors real estate trends. Does that mean if I don't have to sell right now, it's better to wait?
It's so hard to say. I think if you're in the market to sell a house, so maybe you won't get the highest price that you think you should be getting, but on the flip side, maybe you'll find more value.
But they're saying it's a seller's market right now. Whatever that means. If things are undervalued by 10%, I can't see how.
I just don't know if they're undervalued that much.
Okay.
I really don't know. I mean, back to what you said earlier, I think our market didn't fall as far as other markets, so we didn't have as far to go back up. If you look at the California market, that's up, 40, maybe 50%, but we didn't fall that far.
Okay.
Because I don't think we have those tremendous high highs and low lows. I think it's both a buyer and a seller's market right now because you're going to do both. You may get beat up on one side, but you may do well on the other. I mean, I think rates also are fantastic right now, too. So why not take advantage of the interest rates?
You know, just in terms of behavior and so forth, we were talking about this off the air before we got started. The idea of what buyers want from a home these days. And everybody knew somebody who wanted to make a quick buck back in, the early 2000s. I'm going to flip this house. Everybody knew somebody who was trying to pull that. Well, and some of them did it. But I don't really know anybody who's thinking about buying a house and making some quick bucks on it or saying, I'll move up. Are people being more thoughtful about how they buy? Maybe Todd?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree. I think that, quote, get rich quick, scheme, that's long gone. I don't think it doesn't work anymore. Now, the only way I could see that working slightly is, again, the investor that may be going by these single families.
And who has cash.
Has cash. Because a lot of those single families that are the foreclosed are uninhabitable, maybe. And so lending would not happen I could not go in and buy one to live in myself. So they would go in there for cash and fix them up.
You know, the other interesting trend that we're seeing is the fact that the remodeling market has come back at a much stronger rate.
Home Depot did very well this quarter, apparently.
Extremely well. So a lot of folks are recognizing the fact that, hey, maybe our house doesn't exactly fit our family right now, but it sure makes more sense to remodel it the way we want it rather than trying to find a house out in the market that meets our needs better. So I think a lot of folks are really taking a close look at where they live and saying, how is this thing going to work better for me if I just stay here and remodel?
I agree.
Bill and Powell, you're on the air. Hi, Bill.
Hi, and formerly Bill from Powell. I wanted to thank Todd and Rob for all their advice from last year and on a couple of shows, because you were right on target as far as the market changing this year and preparing for the house. So let me just go through some notes real quick, and I'll get out of your hair. We made the decision last year to sell the house this year, and that started the process. So the first thing, as we all know, is I have a great realtor. I was lucky enough to wind up with Sally Beidelman.
No name, no names, no names, no names, no fair. Okay, go on.
I brought a realtor in to do a walkthrough last year. And I'm looking for negative things, okay? And from that walkthrough, we determined what investments we had to make, what we had to fix up, and, of course, to get rid of the clutter. I also last year brought an inspector in on a limited cost basis where my wife and I just took notes and there was no report, but we found one problem which we had to resolve, which we did last year, so we didn't face it this year. Then early in 2013, you know, the street view is very important, 130 bags of mulch, grass, everything was all set.
Oh my gosh.
It's okay. It was a labor of love. And then getting rid of things, garage sale, auction, and I can't mention the auctioneer, but there was an auction involved. Can I mention Habitat for Humanity?
Sure.
Fantastic. And Kidney Foundation, things like that. That's how you get rid of things. But here's what's funny. My wife and I do things differently. I'm a list guy. I got to have an Excel spreadsheet. Yeah. I have a list for things to move to the apartment, leave behind, sell, store, a list of improvements made over 21 years, pool supply costs, utility costs, utility numbers for the buyer so they know how to start the service, the address change list, projects I must do, and pictures of the pool area last year since we were opening up this year.
Uh-huh.
Also, worked on comps, price to sell, very important, we know that. And before the first listing went in, there were three numbers we agreed on. What's the list price? What's the low price? And what's the, for lack of a better word, take the money and run number, okay? So we knew that before the first offer came in. House was listed late April 2013 when the pool was open. Delaware County Realtors came through, did their walkthrough, received an offer on the day 17. No counter was necessary. That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
Fantastic. And the reason for that, of course, again, with the advice of the realtor, we don't know when the next offer is going to come in. It could be 4 months. So why would you want to try to get, you know, $5,000 more? That's ridiculous. So the offer was okay. And the other thing was, it was as is. So I didn't have to do all these projects to keep fixing up the house, and we didn't have any more showings. A couple other pieces of advice. Get a listing agreement well in advance. Get a blank one just so you're familiar with it before you're required to sign it. Look at preliminary HUD statements so you know what your net profit's going to be so there's no surprises. And I will tell you just a couple of things. Comps were difficult for this house. It was a particular house in Olentangy Ridge, mm-hmm. and it was the highest priced home. But we had some pushback, but as our realtor said, look, this house was the highest price 20 years ago when we bought it. It's the highest price today, and 20 years from now, it will still be the highest price. So, again, that's where a good realtor comes in. I did ask after the closing, I did ask the buyers, why did you buy the house? And they said, first, they didn't want a pool, but once they saw it, they liked it. So the wife said they were comfortable about the house, and they liked the acreage and the privacy. And one other pushback was the comps were difficult because we're the highest priced home. And so we'd have an agent for the buyer come in and say, well, for 1.6 acres, we can get this house in the retreat. And our comeback was, go buy it there.
Bill?
Because we're not the retreat.
Bill, congratulations.
Thank you.
And thanks for calling for the update.
Thank you.
We appreciate it.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Central Ohio real estate market with Rob Vogt. He's a real estate analyst at Vogt Santer Insights. And also Todd Helpbringer. He's president of Helpbringer Mortgage Services. If you have a question or comment, you're welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. Or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. It was fun to hear from Bill and hear about everything he achieved. Was it you, Rob, or Todd said he's missed his calling?
Yeah, he definitely. He's a spreadsheet king.
It was a textbook example of what to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that inspector thing, and again, maybe people
smart.
Will disagree. I think it is smart because that way, you know, get your house in a great position so the when the client comes to buy your house doesn't say, hey, this is not right, this is not right. Fix those things so you have the best face forward. I really believe that.
Yeah.
I think he did a good job on that. Good for him.
Yeah. Some analysts have said that second-tier cities will lead the recovery next year. They're talking about Austin and Boston, Dallas, Miami, and others. I mean, does Columbus fall into that, do you think, or not?
Probably not,
okay.
I would say. And, I think that the cities that you rattled off, for the most part, are those cities that are experiencing very high growth rates in terms of employment changes. And, mm-hmm. and I think that that's what they're talking about in terms of what's going to make those second-tier cities very attractive to folks. Austin is a very livable community. We kind of equate ourselves oftentimes with Austin and what goes on there. But they've had tremendous employment growth, creating a large demand for housing there. We don't have those dynamics quite yet here in Columbus, but certainly we've done a lot better than a lot of cities in the Midwest.
You know, a lot has changed. I think you guys have been coming on the show for about 2 years now.
Yeah.
And, you know, 2 years ago, there weren't two grocery stores downtown. Now there are there were two grocery stores downtown, I think one or two. Now there are four. Is it three or four?
Three for sure.
Three,
one more
three and another one coming in. Let's talk about the downtown market. We did last summer a little bit, but how's it looking now?
Well, the research that we've done, Ann, shows that the occupancy rates are extremely high still, and the absorption of all those units has been strong, that we continue to see these units being snatched up by the Generation Y or the 20-somethings, as we call
them.
As rentals, yeah. We haven't really seen the condominium market come back, but I think that a lot of the developers who are looking at downtown or are building downtown are building their product to convert at a later date because we think that condominium market will come back. I think that's inevitable. But the absorptions have been strong. We've got probably 300 or 400 more units in the pipeline right now. That will be added that will dramatically change the appearance of downtown. We're seeing a lot of support from empty nesters and the baby boomers as they enter retirement. The idea of getting rid of that large house in Dublin or up in Powell and moving downtown where there's a lot of activities and dining places and entertainment and the Clippers.
It's funny the different views you can get now of downtown. You can get a view of the Commons. The Columbus Commons now. You can get a view of the Nationwide Arena now.
That's right.
Out your back door.
Yeah, that's right.
You can get a view of 315.
And that's one of the keys to development is the fact that we've got a variety of locations and concepts and product types downtown. So that's going to even greater broaden the appeal to downtown because you're providing a lot of different alternatives to folks. One of the things we were talking about earlier, though, is what's going to happen 4 or 5 years from now? Are we going to continue to have a strong downtown, or a lot of these 20-somethings going to end up getting married and moving to the suburbs when they decide to have children? We don't know the answer to that.
And will they have overbuilt by then,
right.
Or will they pull back at a certain point now and just let that?
Well, one of the statistics that I saw recently was a survey among 20 to 30-year-olds, and they asked the question, you know, where would you like to live? And 77% responded that they wanted to live in a walkable community. And certainly downtown and the Short North and German Village fits that bill very well. And when you take 77% of the several million 20-year-olds that we've got in this area, that's a big number.
It's a different generation. Yeah. They have different expectations, different values for what is important to thing. Different things are important to them now.
And they're putting off marriages, and they're living with unrelated individuals, and it's a completely different dynamic, more so than it was just 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping an eye on what's going to happen downtown is going to be an interesting observation.
And some of the suburban communities are trying to emulate that to a certain extent. I know they're building more multifamily housing in Worthington, upscale, mm-hmm. and in Dublin. They're
That's
desperately
right.
trying to turn that into a walkable community,
That's
which
right.
it was anything but. Even a few years ago.
You had the article about that.
Yeah,
the Dublin.
That's right. Yeah. What's interesting is that a lot of these communities recognize that as these 20-year-olds are moving out of their suburban areas, there's a chance they may not move back. So they recognize the fact that I've got to have housing that's going to meet their needs. Because once they decide to go ahead and settle down with a family, they're going to look at where they currently live and decide, maybe I'm going to live here, or I'm going to move back to where I came from.
And the population is aging.
That's
and
right.
can't handle those 4,000 square foot houses and don't want to have to drive everywhere they
that's
go
right.
either.
That's yeah. that's the two biggest support components that we're seeing for upscale apartments in today's market.
Is most of the construction downtown, it's multi-unit, but is it mostly upscale, or are they starting to bring it down a little bit in places so that there's more diversity?
Unfortunately not. I think land costs and construction costs are dictating a higher priced product that we're seeing rents of what we call $1.50, $1.60 a foot. Just because of the expense of building downtown, that's the kind of rents that they have
that's
to charge.
That's $150, $160 a foot. No?
On a rent per square foot,
yeah.
of 1,000 square foot
yeah.
units, $1,500 a month,
$1.50
a foot. So that makes it tough. And one of the things that I've been advocating is using some of the low-income housing tax credit program, which is it's called the Section 42 low-income housing tax credit program that provides incentives for developers to build product to more moderate income households. And I think that's something that we need downtown, because we've got a lot of restaurants, we've got hotels coming in, we've got a lot of service jobs, even police officers and school teachers need this type of housing.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question about realtors' fees. What I don't understand is, if I sell a house for $100,000, then someone's making $6,000. If I'm selling a house for $300,000, someone's making $18,000.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not seeing any more work involved by the realtor in those two scenarios. I'll take my answer off the phone.
Okay, Mark.
Mark, that's kind of the nature of the beast. I mean, it's a 6% typical commission structure, and that would be whether the house is, $50,000, $60,000, or even $1 million.
Is it harder to sell more expensive
houses?
Well,
yeah, absolutely. It's a much narrower market at the very high end, so you're trying to reach a lot more. You have to reach a lot more people in order to get them interested in that high-end house. So the expense to market an expensive house is going to be much more intense than it is for,
so the percentage,
for a lower price. Yeah.
So the percentage doesn't change.
That's right.
But
yield
does.
Right.
But also, if you ever try to, if you don't like that scenario, try to sell it yourself. I mean, I'm telling you, the realtors do a ton for what they do. I mean, this, setting up the showings, the MLS, negotiating the contract, setting up all your inspections. So there's a lot involved in that whole transaction. I don't think it's as easy as people think it is to sell it on your own. You pay for the expert to move that house and get it on the MLS and get some listings. Look at how well Bill did.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Questions, comments for our guests, Rob Vogt, real estate analyst, or Todd Helpbringer, president of Helpbringer Mortgage Services. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email from Angel. She says, are there programs in Columbus for young professionals who don't have down payments due to student loans? I'd rather live in a ready-made community in Columbus than the sprawl of the suburbs. Also, I'm disappointed with Columbus giving tax abatements to expensive condos. If you can buy a condo at $250,000, you can afford taxes.
That does make sense.
Well,
I do agree.
Can't disagree with you,
right,
Angela.
That's right. No, that's right. And to the defense of the tax abatement issue, 10 years ago we didn't have a lot of developers interested in building downtown, right. And that was an incentive to get them to do that. I doubt that we'll see many more tax and abatements available to condominium.
The market's been established.
That's right.
Now
that's right. We've got some momentum there.
There's not as much risk anymore.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That's right.
But you know, I see her first part of her question was about the down payment.
Loans for people.
Here's the thing that they're getting away with right now. I mean, we used to have a program out there. Conventionally, you could do 3% down, but we don't have any lenders that are offering 100% financing right now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that goes back to them, in my opinion, quote, learning the lesson that you can't offer 100% financing.
Because you're going to attract people who can't afford what they're buying?
Well,
or
I think it just, if there happens to be a problem, something unforeseen, that lender's going to get that property back. And if you lent them 100%, you're going to take a major bath. And then finding people that are going to basically go in there, if it's not in good shape, to fix it back up. How much is the lender going to lose? So they always want down payment dollars, too, nowadays.
Yeah.
Todd, are you often running into a lot of applicants who do have student loans? Because I've kind of understood or heard that that's a big issue. Trying to get those, and one of the reasons that we don't,
as big as a house.
Yeah, that's right. That we don't have a lot of younger households who can buy in the suburbs because they've got the student loan debt.
Yeah, we've not. I mean, the client that we've always attracted has always been, you know, I think a little bit more into their finances, and we've seen they've got student loans. But you know, I think if my opinion, if to offer advice to somebody, if you're thinking about buying a house right now, come in and visit with someone at least 6 months before you're thinking about doing this, because what is changing now and is going to change in January with these qualified mortgages is just much more questions and scrutiny. And I always tell clients, if you think about buying a house in the next 6 months, basically go boring, meaning don't transfer your money. Don't open up any new accounts. Don't buy a car. Just kind of just veg, if you will.
Settle down,
because as you move monies around, the lenders want to know where that money has come from. Well, you have a large deposit. Explain the large deposit. There's so many more questions out there. And furthermore, come in and visit someone 6 months out so we know and ahead of the game if there's something that needs to be tweaked or fixed in regards to your credit. You have plenty of time to fix it.
Will mortgage lenders do that? Will
Absolutely. They
help you figure out how to get ready?
I will speak
to
for
buy?
Myself, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, that's part of our job.
Instead of just saying, nah, you don't qualify.
Yeah, that's part of our job, okay. I think, you know, to basically prepare people for success and show them, here's what you look at today. I always ask people, what's your comfort level? You know, how much do you have to put down? What's your goal? And then back into it.
Do you look at customers as someone you want to keep?
Yes.
For the next house or
forever.
For the next forever? That you have future business with them?
I look at us. We've been around for 31 years helping a mortgage. I mean, we've had retention of customers that probably 90% of our business is just retention. You know, someone we know, school teacher or family or friend. But that goes back to when my parents started the company, is treating people as you want to be treated and basically offering them a great product. Simple concept.
Mm-hmm.
Were some of the lenders, Todd, doing that 3 or 4 years ago
No.
where you became the lender's friend? And
No, I don't think so, because...
Are they laughing at you,
Well, I tell you, there was a story Countrywide, which is no longer around. I remember they came to us with a meeting and wanted us to offer their product that brought them to their knees, this Option Arm program. And I remember sitting in meetings going, I don't understand this product. Why would you offer this to a client? It was a four-payment option where they can go negative amortization, interest only, 30-year or 15-year fix. It just made no sense that each month a client had one of four choices to make on a payment. So I just told the people, I said, I don't understand why I'd offer this. I never forget, the account rep goes, you're the only client that doesn't get it. And I go, that's perfect for me. And,
good
you know,
for you.
And again, I'm not clairvoyant, but Countrywide bit it. I mean, that product brought them to their knees. It was a silly product. But I just think you have to be a responsible human being.
You know, when you're talking about silly mortgage products, we've kind of gotten away from those because of the recession and some of the lending requirements today. What do you think about the reverse mortgage that's starting to be talked about again?
Is it starting to be talked about again?
A little bit.
Because it seems like older people who are stuck in houses, they can't.
Yeah, I don't know a much about it because we don't offer it ourselves, but it is getting more traction. The things that I've heard, you know, it's a heavy upfront cost basis. But other than that, I don't know a ton about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see a lot of those at all. But I think a lot of people that at that point in time of that age group, a lot of them don't have a whole lot of debt on the house because they've been in the house maybe for 20 years and they've paid it down a lot. So I do see some people at that point wanting to refinance, take some cash out to maybe fix up the house to be there long term, but not many reverse mortgages, even inquiries from us.
Email from Matthew in Columbus. We have been talking about this, but he wanted you to talk about the situation, what the situation is currently like for first-time home buyers. So when you're talking about the qualified mortgages and how that's going to change in January, is that going to be harder on first-time buyers necessarily, or is it going to be across the board tougher?
It's going to be across the board.
So if I already own a house, I'm good with it.
Yeah, you're fine.
Everything's fine. But maybe I just bought a car, too. I mean, are they going to be asking the same kind of questions?
Yeah, the same types of questions. But I think I would revert back to what's going to happen in January is what we were doing, you know, 25 years ago, where it's just common sense lending, where you basically have to sit down. It's going to be a full disclosure. You know, there's going to be no more of the, I'll call them silly programs, no more interest only, no more no income, no asset loan programs. I mean, it's basically going to be verifying your income, your assets, and then, quote, the ability to repay. Now, what this new program is doing is that it's reducing the debt-to-income ratios. The maximum debt-to-income ratio is going down to 43%. Right now, it's about 45.
Seems like not very much.
Not very much, but what it was, Anne, in the silly days,
yeah,
it was over 60%. Hmm.
So you could have, what? Explain the debt-to-ratio.
Okay, so you could have debts equal to 60% of your gross monthly income. Say your gross monthly income is $1,000. You could pay out $600 a month to obligations.
And still get a mortgage.
And still get a mortgage. Now, granted, you're not going to have that $400 just for your other living expenses. You know, food, entertainment, things that they don't consider. But that, uh-huh, that $600 could have been car payments, student loans, credit cards. It was just, there was no way for the client to truly afford the house if they were living under those circumstances. So the qualified mortgage is basically just making us more responsible. But again, as we talked earlier, this is what we always should have been doing. The client always needs to look at the payment and then how does that make them feel? Even though 43 is the ratio, maybe you like to do traveling more often.
So if this, when this goes into effect, to a certain extent, the behavior already has set in. But what does it do to the overall, this is national.
Yes.
Yeah. What's it going to do to the market? I mean, are fewer people going to be getting mortgages? Are fewer people going to be qualifying? And
that's a tough question to answer.
Is that the $64,000 question?
Yeah. But I think it's going to go back to, I use the word old school financing. I think there'll still be plenty of loans for the qualified people. I don't think that's going to stop. So if someone really wants to get a house, you know, better than just to give them the house, maybe if they start meeting with a lender, mm-hmm, they can form a plan and basically say, here's my plan. I want to buy a house in 6 months. What do I need to do? It just gives people more incentive to save, mm-hmm, and to have a down payment.
Todd, does it make sense for a first-time home buyer to go directly to a new home builder that oftentimes has special financing?
Mm-hmm. If that's what they're looking
right,
for.
Or does it make more sense to work with a mortgage broker like yourself?
That's a great question. So in regards to the home builder, sometimes they can offer incentives inside the financing, right, which I've always struggled with how they do that because I've noticed that if they stick with their mortgage company, they get reduced costs. If they go with us, they get higher costs. Mm. I don't know how they can honestly do that because then you're basically, quote, steering.
And ultimately, you want to buy the house you should buy for you, not buy something because you're getting a good deal
right
on it.
Right.
Yeah. It's kind of like buying art. Yeah. Buy it.
Because you love
it. Buy what you love, yeah, because you know, you never know.
Well, you know, that's an interesting comment about that, Anne, that a lot of there's a lot of advocates out there today that are indicating that, you know, maybe home ownership isn't a great investment, that you do it because you want to live in that house or want to live in that neighborhood.
Yeah.
It's not the fact that you're going to make a huge appreciation and be able to retire on that nest egg of that equity. But, you know, we talk about that's your single biggest investment in your lifetime. But frankly, a lot of people are beginning to say that buying a home and owning it may not be the best strategy for you.
Yeah. I mean, at this point, a lot of people have a lot more in their investment accounts than they do in their house,
yeah,
all things being
true
equal.
It depends on what you have. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I mean, some people love home ownership, love having a yard, yeah, or whatever that means, and the dog.
Or living in a certain neighborhood where, yeah, you can't get rentals and that sort of thing.
Right. But the interesting thing about that, Todd, is the fact that folks are, in fact, changing their opinion about home ownership, mm-hmm, which is another reason why we're seeing so many new apartments coming, right, online, because people like the idea of renting.
Right.
I agree.
We are going to take a quick break. Then we'll come back and continue our conversation about the real estate market in Central Ohio and beyond with Rob Vogt, real estate analyst at Vogt Santer Insights, and Todd Helpbringer, president of Helpbringer Mortgage Services. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Central Ohio real estate market. What do you want to know? You can give us a call and ask my guests, Rob Vogt of Vogt Center Insights, and also Todd Helpbringer of Helpbringer Mortgage Services. 614-292-8513 is the number to call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jonathan in Columbus, you want to talk more about real estate agent fees. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi, Jonathan.
Oh, hi. Yes, I've made real estate transactions around the country, and the fee is always 6%.
What's the magic?
Right, wait. How come there is zero pricing pressure in that industry? How come during times, good times, or a good broker can't command 7%? How come I never hear of a broker in a bad time saying, no, I'm going to take 5% and get more business? How come that never, ever happens?
Okay. It's a good question.
Yeah. I mean, I've not really seen, I mean, I have seen sometimes in good times where some of them have been at 7%. But I guess also, as I said earlier, it's kind of the nature of the beast. I mean, you know, maybe they don't want to make a stance and say I'm at 7% because I know someone will do it at 5 or 4. Because I have seen some in the newspaper, there's some reduced brokers out there that will do it for 5 or 4%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't think you'll get the same, quote, going to a discount broker as you would from someone that may be charging the 6%. You won't get the same MLS exposure or the,
multiple
literature
listings
and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think there's been some fixed fee arrangements as well where you pay a single fee to represent you in that home transaction, but they don't seem to have gotten a lot of traction here in Central
what
Ohio.
What is the magic of 6%? Is it just tradition or something? It's been like that for a long
time?
It's
been since I've been in business.
Mm, yeah. Interesting. Jonathan, thanks for the question. Maybe a realtor will give us a call and tell us what they talk about behind the scenes. Roger in Dublin, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Roger.
Yes, I had a question for Todd. I have a condo now, and another condo is being sold, and I was thinking about maybe buying that and using that as a rental, and I was wondering what different things do I have to do, like for my mortgage, or what do I need to consider if I was going to go do that?
Well, if you look at it as a rental property, down payment's going to be something. Minimum down is going to be 20%. And then also you have to look at the overall neighborhood and make sure that condo complex will allow for renters. Because some of them really are trying to get more stability with home ownership being, everyone lives there as their primary residence. But if you can find those, they're still fantastic rates. The 30-year fix is probably going to average probably right around 4.75%. So if you can find a renter willing to pay probably, $1,500 to $2,000 a month, that'd be a fantastic opportunity.
Okay. All right, Roger.
You still
thanks
have to
the
collect
call.
The rent, though, Todd.
Yeah.
You do?
There was, during the downturn, during the recession at its most frazzled, that was a big problem for a lot of condo complexes. They had to allow people to rent out, or they were going to have too many vacancies. And who wants to be the only person on your floor?
Yep. Yeah. I think the flip has happened. So to open up where those complexes can then get financing on them, they've had to be more strict in saying, look, we've got to hold this owner occupancy at certain levels.
Right.
Because then you become something that, quote, no one can get in there and get financing unless they go to a lender that would shelf the product and not sell it to Fannie Mae.
Hmm.
So it's a delicate balancing act of how many renters do you want and how much do you want as owner occupancy.
We have an email from Hal. He asks, what does taxation have to do with sales markets? Worthingtonians are generous in providing for local libraries and schools, for instance, and our real estate market is doing well. Is there a general connection? Worthington's always stable.
Well, I think there's been a direct correlation between aging populations and an unwillingness to support tax levies. Arlington has certainly been an example of that to some degree. And I think that's one of the reasons that we are beginning to see some of the baby boomers making a decision to move out of that high tax district in Dublin and Worthington and Westerville and consider Columbus as an alternative because they don't have the kids to put through school. So I think that's becoming a very real real issue among certainly the baby boomers.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Frank in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Frank.
Hi. I had a question. It's a HARP, H-A-R-P, some kind of a government-related mortgage.
Yes.
Like I got a call from one of my mortgage, I have some rental property, and they wanted to lower my rate, I think, from 7 to 5.25. And then also, if you could just comment or give me some encouragement, because I took all the equity out of a dozen properties 10 years ago and got into the car wash business, which has been affected by the economy. And just what to do, you know, when you're trying to pay everybody off. And does the HARP program, like, allow, like, a second mortgage, if you know?
What is the HARP program?
It's a government-based program. They're basically going to allow you, as long as your mortgage was generated before, I believe it's June of 2009, the lender will let us go back and use the value previously established on the property. Because what's happened now, the values are down so low, the client can't refinance. So they're basically allowing us to stick with the previous value. I find it best for going back to the same lender you're currently with. You know, whoever has that loan right there, if that gentleman, you know, has called and offered them a 5.75% rate, there's really low closing costs. He should take advantage of that. Now, as he said, also trying to, you know, he opened some car washes and get some other.
Well, he said he took the equity out of a lot of different properties and used it to open car washes, which are being affected by the economy now.
Yeah. And by going back and using the old value for him in 2009, he should be okay. Because that's basically when he bought. He had to buy it prior to that 2009 date. So he should be okay in regards to those values.
But going back to our earlier discussion, Anne, that we had talking about the number of investors buying single family houses, you know, today is really a pretty good opportunity when you can find that distressed property in a fairly decent neighborhood. And I would certainly not shy away from those opportunities if he's looking for those types of things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. If he wants to sell his property to an investor and kind of get, you know, cash out. Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Or conversely, buy low-cost properties that you can rent.
Okay. All right. Good luck, Frank.
Yeah, then I always wonder, when you get into the thing, when you have those lower, you know, I said earlier, collecting the rent.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the hassle factor of that?
Yeah, I think it would be huge.
Yes. That's a whole nother show, I think.
All right. We talked about this earlier off the air. I want to bring it up now on the air. I've seen several homes going up for sale in my neighborhood. They usually pop up at this rate in the spring, and they're just popping up now. They're not still on the market since the middle of last summer or anything. Mm-hmm. Is this something that I'm just noticing? Is there a reason why this is happening? Usually this time of year, people are starting to decorate for Christmas or...
Yeah, I mean, I think things are a little bit slower on the residential side right now, but we're still kind of active. There's still a lot of homes that are, quote, popping up right now for sale. People are just, you know, saying, hey, I want to get rid of this home now. And
The rates go up?
Possible the rate's going to go up. I really think that rate are not going to go up. I think they're going to be at this level here, maybe plus or minus 0.25%.
What are they at right now?
Right now, the 30-year fix is right around 4.25%. Okay. I mean, they're fantastic.
I think a lot of it had to do also, Anne, with the fact that people simply put off that decision to sell their house during the recession. Hmm. And now that they're gaining some confidence that we're beyond that point, they're starting to sort of a pent-up demand to put houses on the market. So I think that's another reason why we're beginning to see this.
And home values are up a little bit further.
That's right.
Gradually keep going up for people.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi, this is a question for Todd. There's been a lot of stuff in the news over the last few months about trying to further restrict Fannie Mae. And I'm interested in what happens to the mortgage market if those efforts are successful to either restrict their ability to buy mortgages or eliminate them altogether.
Well, I think that is going to be very hard to do. I think they are such a monster out there. You talk about too big to fail. I think that is Fannie Mae right there. So I think there'll always be an entity for them. But I think what they're trying to do with these qualified mortgages, and then the next thing, the Dodd-Frank bill has what's called the ability to repay, is going to slow down Fannie Mae a little bit. I mean, they won't have to attract as many mortgages because these are going to be higher quality mortgages. But I think Fannie Mae, there'll always be a place for that. There'll always be a place, if not for Fannie, maybe on the secondary market. There'll be a fund out there that will basically attract the mortgage market as a whole and basically have investors investing in this fund.
There has to be. I mean, if we don't have someone buying up these mortgages, we're going to have a real problem building and financing houses.
Well, you've got that. You've got, you know, the new onslaught of bringing new mortgages in, but also you have the debt reduction too and people buying and selling houses. Mm-hmm. There's always that influx of in and out of money. You know, I look at some, like we represent a small community bank in Urbana. We do a lot of mortgages for them, but they never have a problem with money because they've got payoffs, principal reduction, lend more money, payoffs, people sell houses.
The way a bank's supposed to work.
Exactly. So I think
the old way.
The old ways, yeah. So I think we'll always be a place for Fannie or Freddie.
Okay, Mark, thanks for that call. Let's talk about the suburban market right now. And you know, we were talking a little bit about lifestyle changes and just different generations and so forth, but... What about the issue of transportation going forward? Maybe Columbus isn't in the conversation yet. Well, it's certainly not in the conversation yet, although there are plenty of people around in Columbus talking about the problem with mass transportation. What kind of impact, if they built it, would they build?
Well, you know, that's one of the things I think personally I've been disappointed with, that we haven't had any light rail transportation here in central Ohio.
From the north to the south.
Or east to the west. Okay. I mean, we have some really natural corridors here in central Ohio that could support mass transit. And if you look at some of the other major cities around, they have something called transit-oriented developments, where they've actually seen a lot of development occurring around these transportation, light rail transportation nodes. And we have, I think, a real opportunity to create some of that type of development here in central Ohio, and we just haven't done it yet.
Is it something that developers have been pushing for? Do they care? Or are they kind of take?
I haven't. I don't. Know. There's not been a wide-ranging support for it
in that community.
Yeah, it's easy to get around central Ohio, frankly. I mean, with all the recent highway improvements and the continuing highway improvements, it's going to be even easier. But I think if we want to take ourselves to the next level in terms of a major metropolitan center, we need light rail at some point to provide that.
That seems to be a big difference between Columbus and those quote-unquote second-tier cities is, of course, the population.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you made the point about the economy and jobs, but then transportation, mass transit.
Infrastructure. They bring it in first and hopefully everyone else will follow. Yeah. We kind of seem like we talked about earlier, we bring in the housing first and then the infrastructure second.
Right.
And as we said earlier, you almost have to bring them as a joint venture so people can see that the infrastructure is there and want to buy. Because if you put the cart before the horse, then those guys suffer, the builders and developers, until the infrastructure is there to bring the people into the cities.
But I think you mentioned, or we were talking earlier about people who are in the service industry, who are working all those jobs that are being created downtown, can't afford to park there, let alone live there, and the transportation's a big issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So, regrowing pains. Is there anything that people should be looking out for? Anything as we emerge from this rat's nest of a recession that...
I think in regards to financing, if we stick with that, I mean, I think we're going to go back to the old norm of basically having to verify and document income, assets, and employment. And there's nothing wrong with that, because as we document things and make you feel and understand the mortgage payment, you will be successful in home ownership.
But it feels, for some people, say they feel like that's what they're going through just to rent now.
Well, that's right, and they have to. That's one of the things that has made renting so attractive is the fact you don't have to worry about getting qualified, right, or getting qualified for a mortgage or maintaining your house. And that's one of the reasons why we're seeing such a resurgence in the interest in renting. That you don't have all those hassles, you don't have to cut the grass, you don't have to clean out the gutters, you don't have to do all those other things that go along with home ownership. And when you begin to look at some of these new properties that are being built around town, they're fabulous. Yeah. I mean, they're like moving into a country club with the swimming pool and the fitness center and the community space. It is some really nice stuff, and it will continue to be a very popular option, at least as we foresee it in the near future.
As we talked earlier, I wonder what the 20s and 30s, you get those. What happens the 40s and 50s?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about the 40s and 50s were that was kind of the generation that was most affected by the recession, because they were the ones that took on these giant mortgages. And it's tough for them to get out from underneath the kind of the mound of debt they created back in that earlier part when you mortgage lenders were making those easy loans.
Right.
Subprime city.
That's right.
Well, so what's the next step? I mean, the next turning point, sometime this spring, we get back together again and look back over the panorama and talk about those qualified mortgages and what the impact's been.
And we should have a couple hundred more apartments built downtown, and we'll see how they're doing.
All right, great. Well, thanks for joining us today. Todd Helpbringer, president of Helpbringer Mortgage Services, as always, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Rob Vogt, real estate analyst at Vogt Sander Insights. Rob, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Ann.
And thanks for all your great questions. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us today. And listen to All Sides with Ann Fisher Thursday. 50 years later, we still grapple with the circumstances behind this assassination of President Kennedy. All Sides will return to the scene for another look at Dallas in 1963. And then, holiday recipes and entertaining for Thanksgiving and beyond. That's Thursday on All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 to noon on 89.7 NPR News. And this is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus. Streaming on the web at WOSU.org.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Next time on Here and Now, CrossFit. It's one of the hottest trends in fitness right now.
Jump, run, throw, row, lift, slam, carry, crawl over, jump over, anything that can increase your metabolic rate, basically we involve ourselves in.
But some fitness experts think it's a recipe for injury. We'll talk CrossFit next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon from 2 till 4, join us for Here and Now. Support comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults, with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. And good morning. It's 11 o'clock.
About 35 million Americans take drugs to control their bad cholesterol, the fat that clogs arteries and stems the flow of blood to the brain. That number could double if doctors adopt new guidelines unveiled last week. But skeptics have emerged to dispute the data behind those guidelines. Some need cholesterol drugs more than others, that's for sure. Coming up on Wellness Wednesday, we'll sort out how to respond to the controversy. Then, as the Affordable Care Act continues its bumpy rollout, we consider proposed fixes and counterfixes. That and more coming up on Wellness Wednesday after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back.